It's Friday, March 9th, 2018. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And as Sean checks out his Twitter feed, I will give you the intro to the show. In West Virginia this week, woo, that's the sound you heard in the intro. West Virginia Wildcat strikers take the day, winning a 5% pay raise not only for themselves, but for all state workers. More importantly, their massively popular strike is waking the sleeping giant of militant labor as teachers in Oklahoma, Arizona, and even Kentucky begin discussing and planning for their own statewide walkouts. Will this signal the beginning of a revolt against austerity and shock doctrine politics? If teachers of Appalachia are showing the way to a progressive future, a Florida teacher was attempting to take us backwards. Raw Story reports that the Florida teacher ran a white supremacist podcast and openly bragged about indoctrinating her students. Gotta wonder if Betsy DeVos will be weighing in on this one after her 2017 CPAC speech claiming that teachers and faculty were telling students what to think. The Trump Organization continues its tailspin with more resignations, criminal charges, and incoherent policy initiatives. Trump signs an order to impose tariffs, leading some awkward pictures of Trump buddying up to some steelworkers and then saying that, you know, to one guy, you know, your dad is looking down at us from above and he's proud of you. And the guy saying, the steelworker saying, my dad's still alive. That was a great moment. The GOP barely has time to register its outrage at Trump's order on tariffs before senior South Korean officials gave a presser outside the White House announcing that Trump is ready to have a sit-down with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. That was another one. And Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions is suing California over sanctuary laws, setting off a standoff between federal government power and states' rights. And, as if on cue, Trump supporters caught on tape threatening to burn down a progressive bookstore in Berkeley. It was International Women's Day or International Women's Strike this past week, yesterday actually, and it sees huge demonstrations and strikes around the world. In Spain alone, millions turn out in International Women's Strike. Unbelievable pictures from that. And a columnist in the Washington Post asked the question, is it time to give socialism a try? I don't think I can remember in my entire life seeing a columnist in Washington Post or New York Times or major paper with that title. Says something. This coming week, we'll see if Godly Heritage beats Nancy's Little Lamb as Rick Saccone is neck and neck with Connor Lamb in Tuesday's special election for the PA 18th. Does this election say anything about the so-called blue wave expected for 2018? We'll get into that. And Greg Edwards, running for a House seat in Lehigh Valley's new 7th District, picks up a huge endorsement from SEIU's statewide council. Edwards adds that to a growing list of progressive endorsements, including Justice Democrats, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Make the Road PA, Women's March Pennsylvania, Common Defense, Working Families, and The Collective. Edwards is running against a right-wing anti-immigrant Democrat in the primary. Yes, I did say Democrat. In many ways, the Democratic primary in PA 7th will be as much, if not more, of a bellwether for the future of the Democratic Party in the state as any other race. And the SEIU endorsement comes days after the DCCC tried to get Edwards, the only candidate of color in the race, by the way, to drop out of the PA 7th. That would have essentially handed the party's endorsement to the anti-immigrant Democrat. Let that sit with you for a sec. And with the Allentown mayor, Ed Pawlowski, finally resigns. He finally resigns, you know, because why? Oh, well, he was found guilty on 47 of 54 charges tied to 9 pay-to-play corruption schemes. Right? The gall of that guy to run for re-election. He just got re-elected this past year, so it's crazy. And whatever happened to the Bunces report? Talk a little bit about that, just because Sean begged me to. And in today's last call, we talk bread. Yes, bread. I finally got the chance to pick up some beer bread from the bread box and bakery in Perkasie. Oh, man, it's great. And Beer Bread is that they normally release it every Wednesday, but they actually had it this morning. And it's made with Free Will's 7-course red ale for the hydration and some of the spent grain for the body. It's really, really good. I had it for breakfast this morning. And they're also going to have Irish soda bread now through St. Paddy's Day every day. And that is freaking awesome. Stephen Hawkins, you know, famed scientist Stephen Hawkins, says we got to get off the planet within the next century because we're wrecking it. And he's serious. And Free Will released Cloudy with a Chance of Charcuterie. Did I get that right this time, Sean?
Charcuterie.
Charcuterie. I can never get that. Charcuterie. It shows you my sophistication. That came out on Thursday, and that's a New England-style IPA. It comes at 7%. It's available now in 16-ounce cans. It's fantastic. It's great. It's cool. So if you're in Perkasie looking for something to do in Free Will, coming out this way, they're going to have beer, and the food wagon, food truck for the week is the Meat Wagon Barbecue. It's great stuff. Saturday, obviously beer, and Trey Locally Sourced will be the wagon. And on Sunday, there's going to be beer and yoga at Free Will beginning at 10:30 a.m., and Down to Earth Cafe is going to be providing the food. Remind everybody to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, and you can also tune in to Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, go to ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon in the sidebar, or just go right to freespeech.org, and all the shows are archived there. Want to remind everybody, I don't know what's happening with my mouth today, but if you like what you hear here on this show, if you like what you read in Raging Chicken Press, we need you to support Pull No Punches Progressive Media today. We want you to become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Because, look, the only thing that keeps this going, the only thing that keeps our servers up, the only thing that gets Sean a little kind of extra paycheck each month, well, it's your membership, plain and simple. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress, and you can choose your membership level there. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. You make a one-time donation by going to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the Support and Membership tab, click Donate, and you're on your way. We also want to kind of put a little announcement out, everybody. We are going to be looking for some new writers. We're looking on the Lehigh Valley, especially given the Greg Edwards race there. We're looking for people that are willing to kind of commit to following electoral campaigns in the state, especially really kind of digging in on progressive candidates and following them, kind of making sure we get the coverage on the ground there, making sure that we hold people's feet to the fire. If that sounds like you, if you want to give this a shot, that's the purpose of Raging Chicken Press here. Not only do we give you the Pull No Punches progressive media, but we're about cultivating the next generation of progressive Pull No Punches journalists. So if you're interested in that, you know, just kind of drop me a line. You go to editor@ragingchickenpress.org, or you can go ragingchickenpress@gmail.com. Go editor@ragingchickenpress.org, I can give you more information. All right, Sean, man, welcome. How's it going?
It's going great.
It's going great.
I woke up this morning, moved my car because it's street cleaning day, got coffee, got breakfast, got milk, and I showered. So I am in a great mood.
How about that? You look a little bit more awake than I've seen you the past few weeks.
Yeah. You know, I hate getting up. I hate getting up to move my car on Fridays because it's street cleaning. So it's like what Jason Kelce said at the Eagles parade. You know, I'm pissed off when I don't have my breakfast in the morning. Well, you know, I'm pissed off when I don't have my coffee in the morning. I had to get up and move my car, you know, at 7:30, 8 o'clock.
Is that every Friday?
Every other Friday.
Oh, every other Friday.
Yeah, for street cleaning, because they ticket you out here like it's going out of style.
Well, that just gives me another perspective, and to say now I understand the alteration between Sean is like a wake little rabbit versus Sean is like, I just can barely get, I don't know what the hell's going on today.
And I also didn't go out last night either. I only had one beer and a wrap at dinner, and that's it.
Well, there you go. Well, man, so big week for mass strikes in the country, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
You guess so.
I guess something happened this week. I don't know what.
Something happened in West Virginia.
About these teachers.
Oh, my God, man. You know, uppity teachers, right?
Yeah, these teachers, greedy teachers. They got their fucking summers off and everything else, and now they want more money.
Damn straight they do. That phenomenal. I mean, unbelievable, huge, huge win for West Virginia teachers this week. And you know, we can get into some of the details of that, but, you know, not only, if you recall, just so we can walk you back through it, just so that you kind of know it, West Virginia teachers went on strike about, what, 2 weeks ago, right? About 2 weeks ago. Originally it was going to be like a 2-day strike, but then it went into the next week, and it looked like that they had an agreement last Wednesday, 5% raise for teachers, and 3% raise for, state workers. But it looked like the legislature was going to balk, right, on that. And the teachers were like, we are not going back to work until we actually have an agreement that it's in writing. So the teachers stayed out, right, despite the fact they had an agreement. And you know what? They were right to do so, because the legislature did indeed balk. They stayed out. The strike continued. They built more popular support. And they walk away at the end of the day, right, coming with an agreement that said 5% pay increase, not just for teachers, but for all state workers, right? Because the rumors were that, look, if they get the 5%, there's no reason that the state workers are going to say we should deserve less. And then that could have been the next round of mass statewide strikes in West Virginia. That would have been unbelievable, right? So amazing. Now, the fight's not over, right? I mean, yes, they got that particular agreement, but now there's threats from the legislature to kind of basically take that pay raise out of Medicaid through Medicaid cuts. The teachers have vowed to say if that happens, they're going to fight that every step of the way. So we're going to see what happens, man. It's like, you know, it was starting to see this taking shape, this whole kind of post-Janus post-Janus world taking shape before us.
Yeah, and one of the things that came out of this, the state senator who's running for Congress, Ojeda, whatever his name is, you know, who kind of got a bunch of limelight in this, he put out a series of tweets last week that pretty much show you why we need labor history in this country. You know, like, pretty much he outlined what happened with the strikes, what happened, you know, these people, these mine workers that went on strike back in the 1900s, you know, they didn't make a lot of money coming out of their strikes. They were still pretty much dirt poor after they went, you know, they came out of their union, but they had better living, better standards of living, you know, better pay. They got off the company store and stuff like that. And, you know, like, that type of stuff you don't learn about in school these days, unless you learn it from your family members who had a relative that were part of those strikes.
That's right.
And, you know, like, here in Pennsylvania, you know, you don't know about, like, any really big labor history or historical events that went on. I mean, you might have spent, like, a day talking about the Molly Maguires. That's about it. I mean, you didn't know about the Latimer Mine Massacre. That pretty much started the formation of the United Coal Workers Association, you know, the Coal Workers Union. Like, you don't learn about this stuff unless it's through the oral traditions of history or through, you know, going back to, or having like a wildcat strike break out.
No, that's
right.
And
basically what Ojeda was saying was that, you know, for decades, for centuries, these people, you know, it's same story right here in Pennsylvania. You had the coal industry come in, they raped the land, pillaged the land, left all the waterways, polluted. You had timber come in, they stripped the mountains clean, you know, two or three times. So really, like, a lot of the trees you see, especially out on the Appalachian Trail, out in, like, say, in Berks County, that's like a secondary fair growth forest. That's not virgin forest. There's maybe a couple spots in Pennsylvania that the timber industry didn't hit that has, like, true virgin, true first growth forest there. You know, it's out in towards northern tier and all, but, like, you know, they came in, they pillaged the land with timber. They came in, they pillaged the land with the coal. In Pennsylvania, they pillaged the land with the oil that was found in northwestern PA. And then, you know, they're coming in again, they're pillaging everything with natural gas. And he's like, when will we learn?
Well, that's right.
And,
you know,
and basically, like, you know, like, these struggles have, you know, centered around the fossil fuel extraction industry. And really, you know, parts of Pennsylvania and parts of West Virginia are nothing more than colonies extracting raw materials out of the ground and sending them to, you know, what Ojeda was saying with Pittsburgh, which was then used to build the steel that built Manhattan or
right.
built up the cities. And, you know, none of that wealth ever came back to the source where the raw materials came from. You know, never came back to the parts of Pennsylvania where the coal came from, never came back to West Virginia where the coal came from. So these people have been living, you know, building up the rest of the world pretty much through their raw materials, and they never got a penny of wealth in it. And then the people, the the companies, the mining companies, you know, basically took that wealth and ran away with it and never distributed it down to the workers.
That's right. And, we should say, you know, it's important, too, as well. The history was not forgotten by, you know, those families. Right. We see you're absolutely right about labor history. I mean, this is one thing that Rick Smith has always been arguing, why he kind of got on board with doing that labor history in two, like every day. It's what we play on this show, too, as well, as a little way to try to remember this particular history. That history has been stripped out of curriculum across the country, and especially in those places that had some of the most militant history. West Virginia, I was reading this past week in West Virginia.
The Battle of Blair Mountain?
Well, the Battle of Blair Mountain, yeah, obviously. I mean, Battle of Blair Mountain was one of the bloodiest, literal battles, right? Like bombs being dropped on workers and things like this. But West Virginia actively sought to purge labor history from its curriculum. So any time that there were kind of favorable mentions of labor history or the importance of labor in the state, state legislators would kind of actively kind of remove those, right? Precisely because it ran amok their funding from these fossil fuel extraction industries. And right now, you know, it's happening all over again. Right now, just same kind of things that we've been covering here in Pennsylvania about the natural gas extraction. In West Virginia, the push from the teachers, right, the push from the people has been tax the extraction industry, tax the natural gas producers in order to kind of pay for some of this budget. But the conservative-dominated legislature will not do it. And so as a result, the threat is that they're going to, you know, go after Medicaid instead. But what I think was so important about the West Virginia case is that those stories that have been held in family histories, right, those stories have now come back out to the surface. And, you know, we were talking a little bit about this before we went on air today, is for me, the biggest victory of the strike was not the 5% pay increase, although that is pretty huge. But the biggest victory was breaking that threshold of fear. Right. And basically saying, look, yeah, they're telling us that this is illegal. They're telling us that we could potentially go to jail and lose our jobs and lose our certification. But you know what? We're going to do it anyways. Right. We're going to do it anyways because it's what's right. We're going to do it anyways because we've been bled so dry that we have to stand up and fight back. And that is the only thing that we have. And it's, you know, you could see it, you know, but watching these interviews with not just striking teachers, but also state workers and community members and parents and hearing them tell their stories. Right now, you start to see that kind of alternative history of West Virginia, not the one that the popular media likes to play out as kind of West Virginia being a bunch of backwater hicks and they don't know anything. Right. But of that kind of long, proud tradition of resistance that has been attempted to systematically be broken, but has lived on in the stories of families. And now I think that's the same thing that is the reason why it's catching fire across the country.
Yeah. And one of the things, you know, did you see Joy Ann Reid's tweet this week about this?
Yeah.
Backhanded fucking comment saying, oh, well, if you went out and actually voted for people who would change your interests, you know, vote instead of voting against your self-interest. Yeah, well, guess what? You know what voting didn't do? Voting didn't get them a 5% pay increase. You know what got them a 5% pay increase? A militant strike.
That's right.
And this is what happens when you take, you know, this is where, you know, this is where electoral politics and union activism shouldn't interact, shouldn't cross. You know, imagine what would have happened if in Wisconsin they decide to go on strike. Like a statewide general strike, instead of turning it into a recall campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, imagine what would happen then. And then another thing is, no Democrats, national Democrats, you know, really showed support for this strike.
No.
So
that's
why
right.
Should we vote for a party? You know, Sanders put out a couple tweets, but like, why should we stand up for a party where people like Schumer or Pelosi or any of the party leaders show no interest whatsoever in one of the biggest labor actions in this country's recent history?
Well, let's not forget the fact that the Democratic Party was complicit in the defunding, right, of public pensions by getting in bed with the coal and extraction industry in that state
The Democratic Party in that state is just as responsible for what the Republicans
exactly.
have done too. I mean, you have Joe fucking Manchin, for crying out loud.
Yep.
who's in bed with the coal industry and doesn't give a shit about the working people, pretty much.
No, exactly. So, I mean, like, look, and you heard that.
And, like, and again, Joe Manchin, where was he at with this strike? How come he didn't get involved?
He was too busy shooting his pro-gun videos, I think, Sean.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like this is exactly the kind of thing as watching these videos, again, like I was saying, these interviews with people in West Virginia around the strike, and they knew that very well. They knew that they had been sold out by both parties, right? And again, when people get to the point where they're feeling that they're cynical, that there's nothing we can do, that we forget what it means to organize collectively, or we've just been beaten down and we need a break, or we're tired, right? And we retreat into our own homes and our families to try to get by each day, and we forget the importance and the power of collective organizing, that, you know, people get depressed and they get disengaged. But when there's that reminder, man, you see people's face light up because they remember what it means, like, to fight back, what it means to take control of the power and not rely upon, you know, like, you know, people at the top of any political party or any corporation or anything like that, but to take charge yourself and say, these are the terms by which we are prepared to go back to work. These are the rules that we are laying down. This is what we want, all right, and articulating that and saying, if you don't meet our needs, or you don't come to the table and have realistic bargaining, you don't come back and kind of like give us what we need, guess what? We're not going to give you what you need, right? We're going to withdraw our labor. We're going to withdraw our work. It's incredible. And so, you know, I mean, as we see this happening, you know, in West Virginia, I mean, the fact that now we're in Oklahoma, right? Teachers have given an April 1st deadline, which is interesting. It's Easter this year, right? So, as my kids call it, Easter fools, right? But Oklahoma teachers have said April 1st deadline to meet their demands, or they are planning on a statewide walkout. And so, remember, West Virginia was 48th out of 50 in funding of teachers. In Oklahoma, they're dead last. Right. And many Oklahoma teachers make less than gas station workers. Right. And that comes out of a report that comes out from CNBC, not exactly known as your liberal bastion. Right. So those teachers are ready to go. And the fact that, you know, again, Kentucky teachers, they're now looking at a statewide strike. And of all places, right, Right to Work Arizona teachers are now talking about going out.
Yeah, it's it's amazing what happens when, you know, when someone sets the example.
Yeah, and exactly. You get to see what it looks like. So, I mean, there's been talk about this. I'm curious your take on this, Sean. It's like, you know, there's been talk about this as being, you know, this just may be the beginning of a revolt against, like, austerity, right? This is kind of one. There was a piece that was in the New York Times talking about this what's his name? Stephen Greenhouse, basically saying that this is the start of a revolt against austerity. I mean, I'm curious your take on that.
I don't know. I'm not too sure about that. I mean, you have to first, you know, you have to fight for what you believe in and what you want, but you also have to force Democrats, you know, who have, you know, pretty much gone in hand with the austerity politics of the past 10 years, you know, since the, you know, you have the Democrats in the Senate who just, 16 Democrats who support rolling back banking regulations this week that caused us the Great Recession, you know, 10 years ago. You have, you know, that it can happen, but Democrats have to get on board, and they have to, you have to change the status quo within the Democratic Party, because obviously your leaders on the state level or your leaders within, you know, the Senate or the House, they're not going to be willing to change that.
Yeah. And what I would say is, like, you know, labor leaders got to get on board too as well. I mean, I think that one of the things that made the West Virginia teacher strike, I think, extra successful, is that even when union leaders came back, said, look, we came to an agreement, 5% raise, you know, promise of a 5% raise and a 3% raise for state workers. The teacher's like, no, we are not giving it. We're not going to take a cooling off day. We are going to stay on strike. And their leaders, there was a great interview in Democracy Now! With one of the teachers who was on strike, who was kind of one of the strike organizers in one of the counties. And I'm just forgetting her name off the top of my head right now, but it was an excellent interview. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But and she was saying, it was like, look, our national leaders, like our statewide leaders, they came and they kind of talked to us and they said, look, these are the potential implications. These are the potential risks. This is what could happen, right? Worst case scenario. So if you decide to continue striking, those things could happen. But if you do vote to continue striking, you have the support, full support of the union, right? And so again, this was the idea, say, we are the union, right? They took the responsibility by saying, look, let's be clear about what we're making a decision on. And the funny thing is about it, I might even mention this on the show before, is that this was the story that, you know, my dad told me about the first strike that he ever worked on. My dad's a union negotiator, was a union negotiator. He's retired now for New York State United Teachers. And during his first strike in Westmoreland School District, that was almost word for word what he had told the teachers. If you go on strike, this is what could happen, because in New York State, it's illegal to strike, right? Or unlawful, however you want to put it. This is what could happen. Some of you might go to jail. Some of you might lose your job. Some of you might kind of lose your certification. But if you do decide to do this, right, we're in it 100%. And the teachers voted about 99% to go on strike in Westmoreland. This is what exact same thing happened in West Virginia, right? That's the model that we need. Because too often what labor leaders are, they get comfortable in their kind of backroom negotiations, and what they see is the political game that's happening with the kind of the power leaders in there, and they want to keep their members, you know, ready to go, but only when they're told to. We need a kind of a labor movement now that is more responsive to more of a militant solutions, kind of an organized membership that is prepared to push. And the leadership is prepared to support its membership, right, and support that kind of fight back. So, yes, we need it in the Democratic Party, but we need it in labor leadership too as well. Crazy. So, meanwhile, that had to be the big news for the week. I'm sorry I cut you
obviously.
Off.
Obviously.
You know, and here's the thing. It's like, and you know, I don't know. I was going back and forth and even putting this on today, but, you know, because it's more drama happening out in the White House and, you know, with these kind of like imposition of tariffs that Trump has put out. And many are saying that he decided to impose these tariffs. It's like, what, 50% on steel, 10% on aluminum. He signed an order. Originally, he's like, there's going to be no exceptions. And now Canada and Mexico are exceptions. And there's going to be some quote unquote flexibility with these tariffs. There seems to be some support, at least coming from the United Steelworkers behind this, because they've been arguing for this for a long time to protect the American steel industry. There's real reasons why to do this. But we should keep in mind that this is kind of, there is no systematic program here. This is kind of like transactional politics at its most like blatant. Right. Trump attempting to kind of, you know, get people on board as he's losing support everywhere. And kind of like as the Russia probe closes in, people are leaving his White House left and right. This is his latest attempt to kind of like, you know, reclaim the news cycle. My guess is that you give it 2 weeks and it's going to be virtually toothless anyways. And I just would encourage, you know, the steelworkers and, you know, look, they're smart enough. Leo Gerard's smart enough about this not to kind of place too much faith in this guy because all he wants to do is use you guys. And you know that. We also see then we get, you know, Trump going to go out, wants to meet with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. South Korean like ambassador or officials come out and they give a press conference in front of the White House saying this is going to happen. Meanwhile, Rex Tillerson earlier in the day was asked the question, is he going to meet? And he's absolutely not. Right. So clearly there's no communication that's going on there. You know, it's nuts. So there's all that drama that's going on. And, you know, frankly, what the strikes that took place this past week, I'm glad that they're in the forefront, right, in some ways. But it could also cover over the drama. It could also cover over some moves that are taking place this week. And I just want to draw attention, people's attention to this if you haven't seen this already. This week, Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions announced that they're going to be suing California over sanctuary laws. And they're setting off this standoff between the federal government and states' rights. In particular, we should point to the fact that there's a couple laws in particular that they're going after. And I just want to put this on your radar. Oops, I got pulled up the wrong one. So one of the laws is, let's see, there's the sanctuary law, right? The sanctuary law basically is... California is trying to do a couple things, basically saying if you are a government agent, you are not to kind of like, you know, assist in, you know, immigration enforcement. That is the job of the federal government. We're not going to use state resources in order to do this. So that is one of the things that Sessions is suing over. right? Also suing over a detention review law. And that law requires the California Attorney General to review any facility where immigrants are being detained by federal agents while waiting for immigration court date or their deportation, right? And this is AB 103, if you're interested. So in other words, the California is saying, okay, yeah, look, if the DOJ comes in or, yeah, if the Department of Justice or Immigration Enforcement, ICE comes in and they're kind of getting ready to deport stuff, they're putting them in detention centers, that the California Attorney General will review any of these facilities, right? Because we know that a lot of these folks have been shipped off to these private prisons, for-profit prisons, that the conditions are horrendous. And so Sessions wants that struck down. And then there's also AB 450, which is called the Workplace Raid Law in California. But basically, what that was is that the law basically prevented employers from cooperating with federal agents during workplace raids or audits. And so what Sessions wants to do basically is to let employers cooperate, right? And they're suing to strike down provisions that prevent employers from letting ICE agents access non-public areas of the workplace during raids or giving ICE agents access to employee records without a judicial warrant, right? So these are the kind of things that that Sessions is going after. And why this is important, right, is because Sessions, they clearly want this to end up in the Supreme Court, right? Because basically what's getting pitted against one another is the whole idea of the federal government versus states, right? And what's ironic about this is that Republicans for the longest time have all been about states' rights in here, right? And that's what California is asserting, while Beauregard Sessions is asserting just the opposite, that the federal government has control here. And there's some implications for this that goes beyond simply just the sanctuary laws. Like, number one, if these sanctuary laws are shot down, right, that means that the federal government could compel state workers, right, to become essentially ICE agents, right, or ICE spies, basically ferreting out undocumented workers. And that is just unbelievable. I mean, you talk about what that would mean in terms of a surveillance state that would take it to whole new levels. So that's number one. But number two, there's this – and, you know, I hadn't even considered this, but there's this is, comes from a Vox article. And in this Vox article – they interview several lawyers about this law and saying, you know, what's your kind of perspective on this? And there's this one guy's name is Asha Rangappa. He's a former FBI agent and senior lecturer at Yale University. And he drew attention to the fact that there's some potential overlaps between the reason why Sessions may be moving forward with this in California. One is a political reason. Obviously, you go after the bluest of states where have been issuing model legislation so that other people are kind of using as a way to kind of enact sanctuary laws. So you go after the strong point. But also because this could potentially have impacts for new gun legislation. So if this if this case goes forward and finds that the federal government, right, has the right to overwrite state law, right, with these federal enforcements, this could potentially use as a way of kind of negating some state gun laws that are now being enacted. So this is just kind of a very interesting case in a lot of different ways and something that we should be paying attention to and pushing back in every step of the way. So just put that on your radar and do check that out because I think it's important that we're up to speed on the kind of attacks that are taking place against immigrant communities. And, you know, look, because we all know how it works, too, as well, is that attacks on an immigrant community in this environment are really racist attacks. Right. Because they do not discriminate between someone who looks Mexican. Right. And someone who is an undocumented worker. Right. So put out there. I would also just put on people's radar. There's this great book by Aviva Chomsky that I'm reading right now. It's called Undocumented. And I want to strongly, strongly recommend people pick that book up and read it. It goes through some of the history of kind of making immigrants illegal and follows along a path. We've talked about Michelle Alexander's book on the podcast before, but looking at the ways that kind of systems of racism from slavery to Jim Crow to kind of mass incarceration have evolved to kind of keep racial orders in place. Aviva Chomsky basically picks up on a very similar theme and shows that how this has happened with immigration law and the relative newness of the quote-unquote illegality of immigration. So, again, that's something that I hope to have a longer discussion about at some other point. So, crazy stuff. Shauna, did you see that by any chance the that video of that guy, of the Trump supporter that was going to burn down the bookstore?
No, I didn't. I'm not surprised.
Oh, my God. It was almost on cue. It was almost like, you know, hilarious. This guy's like got his big MAGA hat on with big American flag draped around him. And him and his friends coming up with, you know, coming up basically to Revolution Books in Berkeley, basically threatening them. And the woman Trump supporter who's there is yelling at the bookstore owner or manager or whatever, basically saying, do you think that just because I voted for our president that I'm a racist? And the bookstore owner is like, yeah basically that's what I'm saying. And then the guy threatens to burn down the bookstore and stuff like that. Oh my God, it's just but this, you know, I only say that as a way, this is exactly the direct line from policy to things that are happening in DC to what's going actually on the ground all over this country in 1,000 different ways a day. So in other good news, International Women's Day or International Women's Strike was Thursday. Huge turnouts around the country, around the world. Spain was probably at the forefront of this. You saw millions and millions of women and supporters showed up for International Women's Strike, and it was just unbelievable. The pictures from that, seeing huge squares filled with millions of people coming out for International Women's Strike was amazing. Again, I, you know, you get that feeling sometimes. You see this kind of stuff. You see the strikes that are happening in this country. You see the turnout for a national women's strike. You see the fact that you've got, you know, constant organizing happening right now. It feels like, you know, we're at the bridge of a new day. And if one sign of that new day is, you know, this column that appeared in Washington Post this week, which really, I don't know, it just kind of blew me away that it's time to give socialism a try. Now, this was an opinion piece by Elizabeth Brunig in the Washington Post. But what was just remarkable was the fact that it was printed. I mean, I cannot remember in my lifetime ever seeing an editorial like this as a columnist given such space on the editorial pages of a major newspaper than this. It was pretty amazing. So what do you think, Sean? Give socialism a try?
Why not?
Oh, man, I'm all ready for it. like, and she ends it with this, like, I don't think that every problem can be traced back to capitalism. There were calamities and injustices long before capital, and I'd venture to say there will be after. But it seems to me that it's time for those who expected to enjoy the end of history to accept that, though they're linked in certain respects, capitalism seems to be at odds with the harmonious, peaceful, and stable liberalism of mid-century dreams. I don't think we've reached the end of history yet, which means we still have the chance to shape the future we want. I suggest we take it. Let's try socialism. You know, what the heck? I'm on board, man. I'm on board. How about that? Crazy. All right, man. This is, I guess we're going to close out the national stuff now. We're going to get some stuff in Pennsylvania. Lots of stuff going on, as usual. Things starting to really heat up in electoral politics in the state, looking forward to 2018. So we're going to get into some of that after the break. I just want to remind everybody that, look, we need you to help support Raging Chicken Press. Go to patreon.com/RCPress and become a member today. Become a member for as little as $5 a month, and you could support progressive Poll No Punches Media. Want to also remind folks that, look, if you're interested in writing for Raging Chicken Press, if you're interested in kind of doing some of the reporting, especially on the progressive races in this state, what's happening around the state, please drop me a line at editor@ragingchickenpress.org, and I can let you know a little bit more about that, and hopefully bring you on board. So in the meantime, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into some of the PA fun and electoral politics. Right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day miners in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, struck for union recognition and the 8-hour workday. They hoped to beat back deep wage cuts and out-of-pocket costs for safety equipment and explosives. As many as 15,000 miners went on strike against 65 mines. Thousands were immediately evicted from company housing. The UMWA helped to set up tent cities. Area coal companies imported immigrant strikebreakers who had little understanding of English or why they were being hired. When they tried to quit and leave company housing, coal company police beat them back to work, refusing to let them leave until they paid the cost of relocation. The situation was so bad that the House Committee on Labor held hearings as to whether workers were being forced into peonage. Injunctions were enforced against strikers picketing on public property near the mines. Many were arrested for simply traveling along public roads. Strikers were also denied access to many municipal services whose facilities were on coal company property. Hundreds of strikers were arrested for trespassing and their leaders held on charges of conspiracy and intimidation. They were routinely harassed, beaten, and fired upon by sheriff's deputies, state troops, and the coal and iron police. Over the course of the strike, more than a dozen strikers and their family members were killed at the hands of security and police forces. The strike wore on through the brutal winter of 1910-1911. Hunger and disease spread throughout the tent cities. After 15 months, the UMWA called off the strike. The union was broke from disbursement of strike funds, and many blacklisted strikers had to leave the state to find work. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. And as usual, I'm sitting here with Sean Kitchen, our capital muckraker in chief. And in Pennsylvania politics today, a lot of stuff going on. Sean, take it away.
We got polls.
We got a poll. We got a poll. And we're not talking a Polish person. We're not talking about a thing that holds up a house. We're talking about a political poll.
Not anything to dance on, but the poll. So next week is the special election between Connor Lamb and Rick Saccone, everyone's favorite waterboarding House representative in Pennsylvania, the state House rep.
Godly heritage.
Godly heritage guy. Everyone's favorite.
Don't play with your spidget finner.
So pretty much recently the polls had Saccone leading up until like maybe March, and it's been neck and neck since. A couple polls came out within the past few weeks. They both have Connor Lamb up 48%. To 44% over Rick Saccone. There's one that 538 decided to talk about from Emerson College, showed Connor Lamb leading Saccone 48-45%. Another one had Saccone up 45-42%. One piece of good news for Lamb: in the Emerson survey, 63% of Lamb's backers report they were very excited to vote next week, compared to 53% of Saccone supporters.
And that's important, right? Because that measures kind of like how much it's likely for these people to get out there.
So it looks like Republicans are starting to cut their losses on this one with Rick Saccone. Basically, did you read the Politico piece?
Yeah, I mean, there you go. I mean, you said that like the national GOP was basically saying, "All right, we're done with this shitbag. Let's go."
This guy's not doing any fundraising. He's posting crappy videos to his Facebook page. You just, like, click and watch some of these videos.
Yeah,
it's him drinking at a bar with like 10 other people. Look, the local Republican Party's out here. Rick Saccone for Congress.
Well, but you know what? This is exactly what like the gerrymandering had brought, right? I mean, you had these candidates like Rick Saccone who could like, you know, tout his like godly heritage garbage, only because there was a virtual guarantee that the most conservative elements in that district were going to vote him in, and it was virtually impossible for a Democrat to get elected. But then now two things happen. Number one, right, we see that, okay, Trump has changed the equation like entirely, even in a district like this one, right? And now it's kind of like, you know, people like him are saying they've got no game. They don't know how to fundraise. They don't know how to run a campaign. They don't know how to do anything except spout their crappy ideology.
45% without putting any effort into it.
What's that?
They're used to winning by 65-45.
Exactly.
55-45 without putting any effort into it. And, you know, just have their name on the ballot and they'll win.
Yeah, and exactly. And they've been also used to the fact that you've got, like, the Democratic Party in the state has been unwilling to kind of run candidates in there or support the candidates unless the candidates wanted to self-fund or something like this. But now they've actually, you know, it took them a long time, but they finally kind of got off their haunches and started backing some of this. We see some outside kind of progressive money starting to come in to support the campaign. And, you know, this is something that we've been talking about forever on this thing. So, you know, Democrats need to be running in every freaking district and kind of supporting that stuff in order to turn the narrative.
Yeah, and well, at least in the state house, Democrats are pretty much running in every single district possible, which is good.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, but one of the things with the Saccone Lamb thing is, I think if Connor Lamb pulls this off, I think the wave is on.
All right, so walk me through that, because I'm not convinced. I'm very, very skeptical of any discussion of the wave.
We've seen it, like with all the other special elections happening, all the other seats that went from Republican to Democrat, and these special elections in state houses, state senate races, and some of the congressional races over the past year. You know, the Democrats haven't had any congressional pickups. I think just Doug Jones beating Roy Moore. That was more of the thing of a pedophile almost winning an election down in Alabama, but. The thing is, you've seen that swing where districts that are like 15, 20 points that go to Trump in the last election have gone to the Democratic candidates. And I believe that if these trends hold up and if Connor Lamb wins, the Senate and the House are going to be in the Democratic hands in 2018.
Okay, so here's my skepticism, and I'm not saying you're wrong, right? As a matter of fact, I very much want you to be right on this, okay? And I see the Roddy report, but here's this. I'll tell you, the only source of my skepticism is this, is that anytime we start describing electoral politics or any politics for that matter, right, in terms that are about nature, right, like a blue wave, right, that is something that happens that is not under the control of people, that doesn't require effort, that is a natural force, I get really concerned, right? Because basically it's like saying, look, it's just going to happen, right? And I don't trust the Democratic Party enough to believe that or let me put it this way. I worry that they're going to believe in their own natural forces of a blue wave, just like they believed in the forces of demographics were going to save the party. That it's just going to happen by itself, right? Now, again, the good thing is that because of Indivisible, because of the Women's March, right, because of the DSA, because of Our Revolution, because of Justice Democrats, right, these non-democratic party entities, right, who do not buy into the kind of natural forces kind of like model of politics that the Democratic Party writ large does, they are basically, no, we are all in for organizing. So that's a good thing. But at some point, when we start getting closer to 2018, we start getting close to the actual election day, you know as well as I do that the Koch networks and all this stuff are going to be in full force. And we are not seeing that quite yet. Yes, we're still seeing the Saccone, what's great about the important about the Saccone case is that you did have outside. We talked about this last week. You did have outside funders come in, putting in kind of significant amounts of money behind Rick Saccone when he wasn't doing anything. And that seems to not have had an impact, right? But we should also remember, like, for example, I'll give you from that political argument article. Here's a paragraph that Trump's advisors, several of whom have been dispatched to the district, have been miffed too at Saccone. During one recent White House meeting, Saccone was critiqued by several administration officials. At one point, first daughter Ivanka Trump, who appeared with Saccone at a small business roundtable near Pittsburgh in February, was asked for her thoughts. Trump told colleagues that she'd been impressed by the candidate, who she described as kind and intelligent, but she noticed that Saccone seemed to lack the charisma of many politicians. Right?
He's walking around with his fucking wet tail and say, who's next? Who's next? Who's next?
Right, exactly. He's like, oh my God.
Underlay.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, again, so that's why I say that is like, it's not as if they've got a strong candidate in Rick Saccone running against a conservative Democrat, Connor Lamb. Right. So that's important.
I mean, they pretty much like they were aiming for Guy Rensselaer or Kim Ward to get the seat, and instead there was a suicide pact that was pretty much made between everyone, saying if whoever gets nomination, goes through the first round balloting, everyone gets their votes. So they all formed a pact against Guy Rensselaer, who was supposed to be the Republican pick in this seat, and they pretty much screwed him out of getting the nomination.
Right. So the question is, right, if you had a more competent candidate in this thing, would we be seeing this kind of race? Right. And that is my reason for that is my reason for the skepticism about this being kind of a bellwether for.
But even in a district where, I mean, it's an R20 district that went 20 points for Trump. Do you really need a competent candidate running for this? No, you don't. And that's probably what they're thinking. Like, all right, I got this incompetent candidate. He's going to win because Trump won this district by 20 points the last time around. And, well, here we are. Connor Lamb looks like he's about to take it.
Right. No. So we'll see. I mean, you're right. I mean, you're right. In terms of the numbers all seem to point in that kind of direction. I just want to be a little bit of the cautious on this before we get kind of too carried away. Assuming that this is just naturally going to happen. I mean, I think that the organizing has to be nonstop between now and 2018 if there's any hope of moving it back. And look, Pennsylvania, and why I'm especially concerned or cautious, let's say, is because Pennsylvania, I mean, just in Pennsylvania, right? Pennsylvania could almost provide the margin to take back the House of Representatives, right? Take back the House in D.C.
Did you see that? Texas Democrats are looking to pick up 3 or 4 seats,
which is unbelievable, right?
Yeah. So Texas Democrats think they're going to pick up 3 seats. If they pick up 6 seats here in Pennsylvania and 3 in Texas, or you get like 7 seats picked up here in Pennsylvania and 4 down in Texas, that's pretty much half the seats you need to take back the House at that point.
Yeah.
Between those two states.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, this is it. I mean, in my mind, it's like, you know, all in right now.
And another little fun factoid about Rick Saccone, as of right now, he is not on the ballot for his House race here in Pennsylvania. So that means it looks like he will not be running for a re-election, or he won't be running at all after next week's loss.
Well, good. That'll be good for everyone else. He can go back to his job of giving tours of the Capitol.
I was going to say providing assistance in North Korea.
Or that, Mr.
Waterboarder.
Donald
Trump's North Korean, entourage, envoy.
Crazy, man. Crazy.
Have you ever seen the man up close?
No, just in very close pictures of him. That's about it.
He's fucking nuts.
Yep. And, Pennsylvania Republican
sure
Party, everybody.
I'm happy that he's not going to be around much longer.
That's good. So let's shift. I mean, okay, the big news in my mind, like, it was like what's happening in the Lehigh Valley right now is incredibly exciting, right? I mean, what's happening with the Greg Edwards campaign right now? I just think all eyes should be on that campaign.
Yes. And before we get into this, I want to correct you. There is another candidate running in this election, Susan Wild, who is the Allentown City Solicitor. She's been endorsed by some of the local like state reps out there. Schlossberg and Schweier endorsed her.
Okay.
So you have Morganelli, Susan Wild, and Greg Edwards pretty much running in this race.
Okay, so Susan Wild. Susan Wild actually has a shot?
I do not know.
Okay. I didn't mean to suggest that.
I don't see a way how Morganelli has a shot with this.
Yeah, some of my discussions.
I mean, if the DCCC is backing Morganelli, an anti-immigrant, pro-Trump stuff Democrat in a solid blue district, then they should just give up.
Well, I agree, but there seems I don't know. Maybe the DCCC wants to get behind Wild, and that's the case, and I'll have to look a little bit more into that. But it looks like
the DCCC has had no official like DCCC candidate out there. I haven't been able to see one yet. But so what happened last week after Greg Edwards, he's raised the most money in the district. They pretty much went up to him and asked him through back channels if he would like to drop out of the PA7 and use that money elsewhere in a state house or a state senate or a state house race, and basically told him to go pound sand and said basically what he made the argument that, this is systematic racism at its finest within the Democratic Party. Here you have the DCCC trying to push out the only candidate of color out of this race and the person who's raised the most money, simply because he's extremely progressive.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, this is that kind of race.
And fall in line with their party views.
Well, and this is that kind of race that I think, you know, I mean, progressives and the left needs to be all in behind Edwards on this one, right?
Yeah. And he's picked up the endorsement of the SEIU statewide council, which is great.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, because look, SEIU right now has, you know, they have the energy in the labor movement in a lot of ways. Although the teachers unions are now picking that up now too as well, which is great to see. And I should emphasize there too as well. These are both unions, right, that have like the highest percentages of them and the nurses union too as well of women, right, in those unions, right? So we should also be clear about that. And I think that by, you know, SEIU getting out there and, you know, SEIU has been active, like super active in the Lehigh Valley, making connections, doing that kind of community-based organizing along with like Make the Road Pennsylvania. Every time I've been there for a rally in Allentown covering those rallies in there, SEIU was there. You had Make the Road PA was there. And these are folks that are kind of putting their weight behind Greg Edwards. And, you know, Edwards has that kind of those kind of connections in the community that I think would really push this forward. Yeah, I mean, I just think this could potentially be a bellwether. If something did happen, if Morganelli were to get this nod, that is going to, you know, from my mind, it should be the death knell of the Democratic Party in the Lehigh Valley. I mean, then people should just start saying, forget you people, we're done. We're going to organize on our own. No, seriously. I mean, it's like, yeah. Because
– I mean, you have the changing demographics. You have a lot of immigrant communities moving into the area. You have a lot of people from New York City who, you know, New York City has become too expensive to live in, which is only like an hour and a half drive from the area, you know, from Allentown. Still pretty easy to get into if you're commuting into New York. You know, or Northern Jersey, and you know, you have a lot of a changing demographic going in there. People moving in, a lot of, you know, immigrant communities moving in, and no, I mean, Morganelli is a fossil at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, having someone that has been active in that community, that has been organizing the community for decades, right, like Greg Edwards, that is.
And he's not just someone who's organizing this community. He's someone who has been training.
Yes,
with Reverend William Barber
in North Carolina.
In North Carolina, the leader of the Moral Monday movement for years now.
Yeah, it's gonna be awesome. Well, you know, the news is I don't want to kind of get too far ahead of myself, but you know, it looks like that we've got somebody maybe or looks like in the Lehigh Valley that's going to want to start pick up some of the coverage there too as well, which is going to be really important because we think that is going to be one of the races that. We've, you know, from beginning to end that we should be covering, and not just for, you know, the horse race of the electoral politics, but for what that means in terms of building, you know, a grassroots movement in the valley. So pretty cool. Pretty cool. It's exciting, man. So, okay, last thing. Sean's looking at the clock, so it must mean it's time for the Bunces report. I'm just kidding. Sean wants to keep every segment to 10 minutes, so I decided that no, right? Much to his chagrin, I'm going to keep on talking so he can check his Twitter feed. Sean's like, you got to see his face. I wish you could see his face right now. It's great. But no, here's a perfect example. I just want to put this on people's radar again. So you remember a couple weeks back we talked about the Bunces report, and that was a report that was put together or that was commissioned by a group of faculty members at Kutztown University. Faculty members who all union members, right? But the report was not commissioned by the union itself. And the idea was to kind of push the envelope a little bit and kind of basically get an independent report on the budgeting practices of the university and the state system of higher education, and to reconfirm what we already know, that basically the state system of higher education and Kutztown University in particular, other universities as part of the state system, are using a kind of a budgeting practice which is designed to create a false impression of crisis in order to kind of centralize control from management. Okay. So this past week, I was going through and just trying to organize, going through and looking at the history of our coverage of this issue, right? And frankly, I didn't remember half of this, but my very first article ever for Raging Chicken Press when we launched in July 2011 was about this issue, was about the budgeting, right? And so I put together this list, and I'm actually going to link it in this. I'm going to link it in this the show notes for today. That's going through our entire history from 2011 to the present, looking at and kind of basically coming at this issue and kind of demonstrating through kind of independent reports, through kind of research, through kind of budgetary analysis, a whole bunch of different things about the why the budgeting practices by the state system of higher education are corrupt. And the thing that's kind of important to point out here is that there's this kind of agreement that has been made. I shouldn't say agreement because it's not an official agreement. Is but you've got fear is kind of ruling the day on the side of faculty and staff and all this, and kind of status quo is kind of ruling the day when it comes to administration. This is what I mean by this. The administration has, and again, we have a documented policy, which I'll talk about in a second. Documented policy from the administration to basically create two sets of books or two sets of budgets, at least the budget that they project to the public, right, which shows deficits, which shows to the faculty that there's deficits and everything, the sky is falling, and their internal reports, which basically shows the money that they do have to do with what they will, which shows a lot more kind of flexibility than they're showing the rest of the public. Now, the reason that they're doing this, some people say that is to argue for increased state appropriations, right, because if they show that they're actually in deficit and crisis, they can get more state appropriations, right, to do with what they will. But at the same time, they have to tell faculty and staff that too as well, because the way that they want to re-engineer the universities is through cuts in faculty, cuts in programs, kind of increase in distance education, right? Basically, you know, increasing workload, increasing temporary faculty, increasing precarity on campuses as a way of kind of like maximizing the amount of funds administrators have to use. So this does not mean that the Pashi system is flush with cash, right? That is just kind of like has everything it needs. It means that this is a power struggle about who gets to kind of make determinations of what happens in higher education, all right? So is it going to be the administration investing in pretty buildings and beautiful grounds and, you know, buildings with their names on it? Or is it going to be in the classroom through a kind of individualized instruction, small classes, and investment in faculty to kind of deliver the best education possible to students? That is what we're talking about. The third component, of course, with that is that we're always talking about those decisions ultimately impact the student debt, right? Because if you're investing in education, right, if you're investing in faculty, if you're investing in resources for students, you're investing in scholarships, that means lower student debt. If you're investing in buildings and grounds and beautification and PR campaigns at the top, right, you're kind of basically offloading that onto students' backs, okay? The fear component of this, right, means that what faculty have been afraid of. Because, look, this idea about this dual budgeting process from Pashi universities, this has been known for a while. But the fear has been that if faculty say this, right, if faculty make this apparent, right, in other words, if you tell the truth, right, if you tell the truth, then Republicans are going to use this as an excuse to cut the funds for Pashi, right? And let's be clear, that's a realistic possibility. Right, that they're going to try to use this. Now, what is missing, of course, from that equation is what we see in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky, and places across the country. Right, the idea that, well, what defends against that kind of act, that Republicans going after higher education? The only thing that defends against that is organizing. Right. So the idea that we should not tell the truth to the public, that we should not tell the truth to our students, that we should not tell the truth about what's going on, what the administration is doing, right, baffles my mind. Okay. So the other thing is interesting. So anyways, going back, so I was compiling all this list of study, which I'll link in here. And one of the things that came up that we're going to be talking about more over the next coming weeks and months is that if you remember back 2014, I want to say, might have been after that, there was a case that came out of Westchester University. And in that case, there was an administrator there who was, you know, doing budgeting and finance stuff, who basically was confirmed exactly what I just told you, right? Except the difference was, of course, she was an administrator. So, you know, theoretically, people trust her more, right? Because they don't trust faculty at all. They think we're all self-interested slobs, whatever. But basically, she had documented this process, had emails directly from the state system of higher education instructing her, like ordering her basically to construct these two different kinds of budgets, right? So it wasn't something that was just an aberration someplace. It was something that was being orchestrated through the state system of higher education, by ordering their people on the campuses to do this, right? And she refused to do this. And as a result, she got fired, right? So in those court documents, right? I mean, I've read all those. I've written about them. You'll see them in that list of articles in here. In those court documents, right, you can see exactly how that process laid out. Now, that case has been kind of making its way through the court system. Now, we're kind of at a crucial moment right now because there was just a recent decision that was basically saying they're going to – okay, so she was fired, and then she filed a legal case, a whistleblower case, right? And now this case, this case has been kind of pushed back against by U.S. district courts and federal courts, basically saying that no, she doesn't get these whistleblower protections, right? So there's a big question here about what's going to happen with all that information that she came forward with, right? What are going to be the implications of it? And is this case ultimately going to be an indicator of a pushback against whistleblower statuses, right? And was that going to have a chilling effect upon the rest of us? So I've been looking back into that, going back and reading over some of these court cases and stuff. So look for some reporting on this coming forward in Raging Chicken Press in the days forward. Because, you know, the fact that we've got, you know, this court case that is kind of reemerging, right, back into the news a little bit, at the same time that, you know, here at Kutztown University, we commissioned the Bunces report. They're showing exactly that these practices are continuing. It's exactly the same kind of process that we saw at Westchester University. It continues to happen in the state system of higher education, right? And so my case that I'm going to be making, right, is that what we need to be doing as a union, what we need to do, all union members, right, whether you're talking about staff or faculty unions, need to be organizing around this stuff, right, and articulating with students an alternative vision of how we actually use funds in the state system of higher education. And together, then we can push back against any kind of Republican efforts to increase their cuts. If you went back and listened to any of the budget hearings in Pasha, you can see, look, you got Scott Walker, you've got Eichelberger, you've got the Republicans, and frankly, coming after Pasha full throttle no matter what we do. So we have to organize anyways. With Janus coming down, organizing is all we have left, right? So we might as well tell the truth, work with students, and push back against this kind of these austerity policies. Let's take a page out of the book from West Virginia teachers. Let's take a page out of the book from Oklahoma teachers and basically say that, look, are we ready to stand up for what we believe in, right? Or are we going to try to kind of like pretend that by just keeping our heads down and taking care of our own little parts of life that's somehow protect us, right? Which is just a load of garbage. So anyways, that's where we are with we're at the Bunces report. I want to just keep that in this conversation. I'm going to have to – Sean, wake up. Wake up, Sean. Sean, wake up. Sean has told me that there's lots of people that just don't appreciate me talking, so that's why I'm going to talk more. Lots of people includes him and I think one or two other people say, oh, my God, that Mahoney guy just keeps on talking. But
exactly.
What can I do? All I can say. So then talk more, Sean. What can I say? Or we could just keep to your 10 minutes and get out of here, right? That's what Sean wants to do. He wants to just go. He wants to go. All right. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We come right back. We'll go back into the last call. We'll talk beer. We'll talk a little bit of space news. And we'll talk even bread today. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Remember, become a member of Raging Chicken at patreon.com/RCPress for a little $5 a month. Support Movement Media, folks. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper, Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chickens Out the Coop. Last call. Here we are, folks. Yes, it's a last call where everything is possible. We talk beer, we talk space, we talk bread. What, bread? Yep, I have to lead off with this because I've talked about this a couple times now. There's this awesome bakery in Perkasie called the Bread Box and Bakery. It's run by the same guy who runs Down to Earth Cafe, which they serve food at Free Will too as well. But they've been actually putting together. Their bakery is phenomenal. But they got together with Free Will and they just released a few weeks ago now beer bread. Right. And it's through a partnership with Free Will that basically are using the kind of 7-course red ale from Free Will for the hydration of the bread. And they're using some of the spent grain for some of the body. And I was finally able, usually they only release it on Wednesday. And this Wednesday they were closed because of the storm that came through here, which we got a ton of snow again. They were closed again. And I went there this morning after I dropped my kids off for school. I swung by, said, what the heck, I'll go by and pick up some bread today. They had the beer bread. I'm like, oh my God, yes. So I grabbed a loaf of the beer bread and it's as good as I hoped. The crust on it is absolutely fantastic. I was also thrilled that they have, now through St. Patrick's Day, the 17th, every day that they're going to be, baking Irish soda bread. And I'm telling you, their Irish soda bread was great. If anybody has like experience with Irish soda bread, a lot of times people make Irish soda bread, it comes out really, really dry and crumbly, right? This one had just like the perfect amount of dryness. It had a nice sweetness that ran through the bread. And so that was awesome too as well. And then to my surprise, like they had a whole new kind of like series of breads that they baked out. There was a focaccia there that was there. It was unbelievable. I didn't buy it because it was just I had too much bread. You know, they had a focaccia, but I did buy. They had a Kalamata olive loaf that was again a nice thin kind of like focaccia-esque type of bread that was there. So if you're in Perkasie, if you're looking, you want to come in, you're for whatever here earlier in the afternoon, they usually close at 3. They're open Tuesday through Saturday. You stop by the Bread Box and Bakery. It's kind of right on the main thoroughfare in Perkasie. Walnut, I guess. Walnut, Main. I never know the names of my own damn town, the streets. But if you kind of come through Main Street in Perkasie right there, you're going to see Bread Box and Bakery and go pick up some of that stuff or talk to them about it on Sunday if you head by Free Will for their yoga and beer stuff. So that'd be cool. So check it out. So so that's the kind of guy. Any kind of beer news or any kind of fun news out your way, Sean?
He says nothing too much going on out here. Kind of like a dead period, a lull for like the beer stuff out here.
Yeah.
I went to Bresky's beer distributor the other day. Mm-hmm. I went to a beer distributor for the first time in forever. It's usually just used to getting like canned fresh beer from Pizza Boy, but like nothing's been doing and I want to check it out. Plus I want to do it, like there's a homemade German sausage place in the area. So like they smoke their own sausages and everything there on site. They make different types of bratwurst. So I picked up a pack of Wisconsin cheddar bratwurst, which is awesome. Mm. Really good. And then there's Bresky's, which is owned by a state rep. It's one of the biggest like beer distributors in the area. And now with the four packs, you know, you can go in there and buy four packs now because the laws being changed last year. I picked up a four pack of Neshaminy Creek's Shape of Hops to Come, which is a nice piney, resinous double IPA. And then I got an Evergreen Juice Juicy four pack, which they're from this area too. So,
nice.
So I just got a couple four packs I'm sitting on.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Going through a little bit.
That's pretty cool.
You know, I haven't been drinking as much lately from being sick last week and just cutting back.
Yeah, neither have I. Actually, I haven't either. I just had last night, I had the, what did I have last night? I had a beer last night for the first time in a couple weeks, actually, just because I've been so busy at work. But it's been pretty crazy. I knew that Free Will this week, I should say, they release Cloudy with a Chance of Charcuterie. I can never say that word. I can never, ever say that word, even when I practice it. And which is really nice. This is not their first time that they've released this, but it's really nice. Nice and cloudy. It's really, you've had that before, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty good. But one of the things, so you can pick that up. They're still available in four pack cans there. That's pretty good. If anybody's was out to Saucony Creek for their anniversary last weekend, I'd love to hear what you got to say. That'd be kind of, I wasn't able to get out there last weekend, but, you're good. One thing that I'll have my little bit of space news for the day. I don't know if people caught this week, but Stephen Hawking, right? You know, the scientist Stephen Hawking, the guy who's confined to a wheelchair and so on. He's basically starting to put out the warnings that, look, we've got about 100 years left on this planet before we start seeing some of the significant impacts of climate change and a bunch of other things that we're going to start exhausting certain resources. So he's given it 100 years, and he's making a strong push to say that, yeah, we got to start becoming an interplanetary species because we're running out here on here on Earth.
Get to become mall men.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. You say mole men or mall men?
Mall.
Oh God! There we have it.
There we have it. The lizard people.
The lizard people. No, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, you see the fact that you've got this just it kind of puts it in the mix, right? Because I mean, a lot of the ways that we're talking about, and I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, I go back and forth on this stuff all the time because on the one hand, there's a certain aspect of kind of what I've been talking about in terms of space exploration and so on. Which is, it's really about the kind of extension of extractivism and kind of billionaires, you know, kind of like pet projects. And that is true. And at the same time, right, there's aspects of space exploration that I think kind of are important, not the least of which is kind of like, you know, if you're thinking about the long-term survival of a species, right, or expansion of a species, and how much of that really is, and this is, again, where I go back and forth on time, how much of this has to do with a very specific kind of perception of what quote unquote humanity is. That is, you know, are we talking simply about kind of white settler colonization mindset, which is just being extended into the future? Or is there something about kind of, you know, human beings that are kind of associated with this? I go back and forth on that stuff all the time. But interesting enough that you got Stephen Hawking weighing in on this and saying, yep, we got 100 years left. So it's either the way I think the best way to take that is to be able to say, go back to right what Naomi Klein has said, right? This is why we have to have bold action on climate change, not just these half measures, but rather we have to kind of radical solutions to what we're doing to this planet.
I hear Jill Stein's going to fix that. So
yeah, did you hear about that? I heard you. You decided to kind of poke the pig on Twitter this morning on that one.
I like going hitting that. I like hitting that. Fucking beehive every once in a while.
Yeah, well, you did that this morning, I guess.
Yeah. Well, come on. I mean, all right. So there's rumors that Justice Kennedy might be retiring this summer. And you know what? I'm sick and tired of some of the people who, like, are Jill Stein purists. Like, okay, let's let Jill Stein fix the next Supreme Court justice then, since everyone loves her so much. Yeah. I mean, I wanted a pony, but I didn't fucking get one. So.
Well, Sean, but you should then just pretend you've got your pony.
Yeah, you know.
You should. You can live in the land of wishes.
Yeah, I'll put that aside, you know, with trying to live paycheck to paycheck.
Well, that's exactly it, right? I mean, this is, you know, we were talking a little about this before we went on the show today. It's like, this is exactly the issue, is that, look, I have no problem, right? I have no problem with saying, talk about what should be, right? But when the should, you know, again, this is a cliche, when the should is the enemy of the good, right? The fact that what should be becomes the enemy of kind of the practical on the ground considerations, then we end up with someone like Donald Trump, right, who picks a Supreme Court justice who is going to essentially turn us into right-to-work nation, right, who is gutting our kind of like, you know, institutions which took decades of struggle and fight and like people like bled and died for those things is now being wished away, right, because you want your pony, right? I mean, that has got to stop. And, you know, it's like this kind of like complete like head-in-the-clouds idealism on the left sometimes. That, you know, again, I think, look, in West Virginia, I hate to, you know, continue to come back to the hammer, but look, West Virginia is basically, this is what the kind of the militancy of the labor movement bringing back is like, that's the kind of thing that people have to kind of deal with. Okay, you might have the idea where you want to go on the horizon, right? But what's missing on the left are the practical politics of how to get there. Right. And frankly, it's not kind of like, you know, you feeling morally justified in like casting your vote. Right. I mean, it's like your vote should not be like an expression of yourself, of your internal moral like compass. It should be an expression of like how the hell we move the ball down the road. Right. And frankly, you know, the arguments, and I have one of my friends, we argue about this all the time. One of the, you know, the fact is like, well, if you don't vote for Jill Stein, then, you know, there will never be an alternative to the Democratic Party. Right. That idea, so that somehow that vote will magically transform and turn into something. No, no, no. You know what? You know what changes? You know what changes the Democratic Party or makes possible a third party? Right? Is you organizing in the freaking streets every single day in order to kind of like gain the skills for practical change. Right? That means organizing in your workplace, organizing your community, not just like spitting off on Twitter, right, and social media about your ideological purity. So, last call, man.
Pour you a stiff shot.
Damn. I just, you know, I was trying not to, but I just, whatever. Whatever, man.
And on that note.
And on that note, Sean wants to get out of here. Yeah. So, you know, listen, folks, I've been really encouraged as by way of kind of closing out today. I've been really encouraged by, you know, I've been getting some we've been getting a couple news tips that have been starting to come in through the website, which is really cool. Some stuff that we're going to be following up on. Appreciate those coming through. That's very helpful. Also, I'm telling you, it's like what's been extraordinarily helpful is that, you know, people listen to this podcast and people will read our stuff. Getting on our Facebook page and liking our Facebook page and rating us on our Facebook page, that becomes really important. You know, we had a period of time which we had a bunch of right-wing trolls that were coming on and trying to kind of like ding our ratings there. But, you know, thanks to you all out there who come back and kind of give us the ratings, we've been able to push back against that. That's been fantastic. But leave us ratings. Like, if you listen to this on iTunes, make sure that you go and leave us a review and give us a rating on iTunes. This kind of bumps us up there. If you're listening on Podbean or whatever kind of podcatcher you're using, make sure that you're kind of leaving us some, you know, some feedback, making some comments, kind of giving us a rating. That helps. Like, I can't even tell you. You know, again, depending on how far y'all get in this podcast, if you listen through the whole thing or just different segments and stuff. Really, I think right now is the time that we're going to need to double down on making sure that we get some solid reporting that's going on for Enraging Chicken. And we want to make sure that we can bring some new writers on. So if you know somebody who you think wants to do this kind of writing, make sure that they, you know, drop me a line at editor@RagingChickenPress.org. And we'll bring some people aboard. What we're really looking for right now, we've got some great commentary that we've brought in, which has been fantastic. But what we're looking at doing is having people that are looking to dig in on kind of local struggles, following electoral politics, following on the ground organizing, and that want to report on that stuff that's going on. We were able to do some of that for a bit, right? But, you know, again, all of us that do this are doing this as second or third jobs, right? We do it when we have time, when we can fit it in, when we're not exhausted. And that's tough. So the best thing that we can do to combat that is make sure that we have kind of more writers, right? So that we kind of spread it out a little more. Now, ideally, what I'd love to see is us to be able to kind of support at least our writers in terms of like part-time positions. You know, think about that. If we were able to kind of pay somebody got a decent wage for having a part-time job for Raging Chicken Press that would be devoted to this. I mean, that's my kind of like down the road goal. But we're moving in that direction, right? But the only way that we can do that is with your support. And, you know, I hate to sound like an NPR fundraiser guy, but, you know, that it's really true. The only way we do this without relying upon, you know, some fanciful, you know, like billionaire out there is going to drop us a load of cash or kind of like forcing ourselves to, crawl before advertisers is basically to support ourselves in the community, like having people like you show up and becoming members of Raging Chicken Press. And you can do that. Remember, patreon.com/RC Press. Make sure you become a member if you can afford it. We're going to have more member content that's going to be coming out soon. I just got a camera that's coming in that hopefully going to be doing some video updates for members only on the Patreon site. We'll see how that goes. Obviously, everything depends on time. We're also looking forward to down the road. We'll see if this works out. I've got a project that I'm working on right now that we're going to be doing some kind of mini documentary work. If it works out as I am expecting it going to be, we're going to start releasing some of that stuff too as well through Raging Chicken Media. So we've got a lot of kind of plans right now, but we need your help. We need you to become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Again, patreon.com/RC Press. So, Sean, anything else for the good of the order?
Nope, that's everything.
All right, man. Well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. All kudos to West Virginia. Look forward to Oklahoma. Pick up the fight, everybody. See ya!